Good evening, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to Moms Fighting Autism. I'm your moderator, Nancy Bernotitis. I have a 14-year-old son with autism, and I've been very active in the autism community since he was diagnosed at the age of four. I've served as president of the Autism Society of America Dayton chapter. I've worked as the assistive technology specialist for Goodwill Easter Seals, and I'm a regular contributor to Autism Today. There are two ways to participate in tonight's webinar. You can log in to momsfightingautism.com, and about halfway down the page, you'll see a box that says register for this webinar. The webinar is completely free. Once you're registered, you'll see a blue box in the upper left-hand corner of the screen, and there you can click listen in and hear the discussion via the internet, and click ask a question if you'd like to submit a question for our speaker. You can also listen in by phone by calling 949-333-4806, and enter conference ID 168978 pound. A list of local call-in numbers is also available at the website. All callers are immediately muted, so don't worry, we can't hear your background noises. Later in the webinar, I'll let you know how you can ask a question directly to our presenter if you're calling or listening by phone. When the slideshow begins, Internet users can go to their blue box and click Slides to view the slideshow. It takes about 19 seconds to connect, so just be patient. Once the slides are up, you can synchronize the slides with either your phone or the webcast audio by clicking the button at the bottom of the slideshow. Be sure to mute your computer if you're listening by phone so you don't get an echo. We have 2 hours for tonight's webinar. So without further ado, let me introduce our presenter tonight. Tonight we welcome Dr. Jim Ball. He has a long bio, but I'm just going to tell you a little bit about him. He's the president and chief executive officer of JB Autism Consulting. He is the director of clinical services for New York Families of Autistic Children Incorporated. He's a board-certified behavior analyst doctoral. He has been in the field of autism for over 25 years, providing educational, residential, and employment services to children and adults affected by autism. He is also the director of clinical services, oh, I already told you that, for the New York Families of Autistic Children, NYFAC, a private, not-for-profit organization providing support and training for children and families in New York City. He provides private consultation to organizations, schools, and families regarding staff training, parent training, home support services, classroom design and support, and behavior management and assessment. Welcome, Dr. Ball.
Thank you, Nancy. Thank you. Thank you for reading the short part of that bio and inviting me to be here tonight. I'm actually very much looking forward to it. We got in New Jersey about 4 inches of snow, and It's almost as bad here as it was for Irene when we had the floods, but it just seems to be getting earlier and earlier, our snow. Last year I can remember it happening around Thanksgiving. So it's a little cold here right now, but it's still beautiful in the Garden State of New Jersey, and that's where I'm from. And I just want to welcome everybody and tell them, even though I'm from New Jersey, please don't judge me by what you watch on television. because I think a lot of times, people go by either the housewives of New Jersey, and believe me, I married a Jersey girl, and she's not like any of them. And then they go by, my favorite is Jerseylicious, and I don't know if anybody's ever seen that, but it's a horrific show about New Jersey. I think the only one that's probably the most like New Jersey is Cake Boss. I mean, that is, that's authentic, Hoboken, New Jersey, and is really true to what New Jersey and its towns are like. And then the last one by far, which is the one that I think most people know New Jersey by, is Jersey Shore. And rest assured, Snooki is not from New Jersey. She's actually from Staten Island, so we don't take credit for her either. So what I'd like to start with is on my first slide, you can see there's a copy of my book, and we are going to talk about early intervention tonight. However, most of what I'm going to discuss with you and go over during, our time together is really going to be things that you could use for any child and or any adult on the spectrum. These are strategies that are research-based, They are evidence-based. They are best practice out there in the field. And as we get into the conversation a little bit more, I'll explain that more and more. But I do, you know, really like to talk about advocacy first, because I think we've come a long way in the 25 years that I've been, you know, part of the autism community as a professional, because I can remember, you know, my first exposure to autism was actually in an Elvis film. And I don't know if any of you are Elvis Presley fans, but and if you remember his last film, but one of his last films was called A Change in Habit. And a very young Mary Tyler Moore was in it, and she was a nun. And in that show, they cured a young man with autism. And most people don't remember that part. And they called it hug therapy that they used. And that was many, many years ago when they were first starting to talk about this thing, you know, that now we call it an autism spectrum disorder. And then from there came a lot of different information. And it's always funny because I always go back to a show, and this was way before I got in the field too, of a show that I used to watch called Sane Elsewhere. And it was a show that predated, you know, all of the hospital melodramas now, like House or ER, and it was one of the first ones, and it was about two doctors and their lives in the hospital. And during their time in the hospital, they, you know, helped a few people, cured a few people, but mainly it was about the drama between them and the nurses and the whole, you know, relationships that were going on in the hospital. However, there was one episode where there was a young man with autism. One of the doctors had a son on the spectrum, and he had come in, and during the episode, he had a meltdown, and they couldn't calm him, and they ended up moving him to a room. And when he was in the private room, he was still having his meltdown, and they were trying to, you know, figure out why. And there happened to be a Native American gentleman in the building, and he wandered into the room, looked at the young man on the spectrum, and the meltdown stopped. So, in layman's terms, for me, when I was like just starting out, I hadn't even heard the word autism before. I just thought that only Native Americans worked with kids on the spectrum. So it was giving some mixed messages to people, I think, you know, early on. And that's still in the time when they really still believed, you know, in old theories, you know, like the Bruno Bettelheim days of refrigerated parents, which we know is not, you know, in fact, even close to, you know, true at all. And we know that it's a biological disorder. However, even back then, and this was in the early 80s that these things were going on. But now, I mean, if you look at any of the shows that are out there, you know, you can see that in Parenthood, I think it's Parenthood, also Boston Legal, that they're now starting to have, you know, characters with, you know, Asperger's or autism spectrum disorders. And also, interestingly enough, you know, the first movie that really put us, you know, on the map in advocacy was, you know, Rain Man. And I don't know if you've seen the movie or remember the movie, but it was a very well done movie. However, it was a little bit misleading, I think, at the end, because, you know, Raymond Babbitt was a person on the spectrum that was, you know, somebody that could live in the community, could work in the community. But I think at the end of the movie, again, you know, we threw out there that he needed to go back, you know, to where he was living at the institution. And I think, you know, for all the great things it did, I think for the lay public, it didn't really help, you know, autism in general, in knowing that, you know, because after that, the inclusion time really started on understanding that we needed to get, you know, these young people and our adults into the community more, you know, for integration purposes, for them to learn skills, you know, in real good life skills. But I think the most important one, and if you haven't seen it yet, you should see it, is the Temple Grandin movie. I mean, it's such a great movie for professionals and for families on hope and on aspirations, and seeing somebody, you know, develop, you know, as a person and do all the wonderful things that Temple has done in her career. And it's a great movie on also showing all of the talents that all of our people have. And I think that's just an awesome thing. But I do also think that we're really not even sure of what the numbers look like for people on the spectrum, because At this point, I mean, the CDC is really looking at 1 in 110. Some people throw out the number of 1 in 100. So for every 100 children born, there will be one diagnosed with autism. There happened to be a study that came out several months ago out of Korea, which was looking at even, I mean, 1 in the 60s, like 1 in 63, I believe it was. And their study was a little bit better done because the prevalence studies in the States from the CDC are really studies that look at paperwork. And if the child has an AU diagnosis, an autism diagnosis, then they would be counted in that count. If they don't, then they wouldn't. And I know for a fact that a lot of states, you know, don't always have their kids in educational settings diagnosed with an autism spectrum disorder. It might be other health impaired or other things that fit what their programs might look like. So I don't think they're captured in those numbers, because I think in the South Korean study, they went to every school and saw every kid. And I think did pre-screenings to really look at, and I think those numbers are greater, because the main reason I have my book on the first slide is because autism impacts so many different families, and it impacts so many different stages of society, and I think we don't give people enough information all the time on the best strategies to use to help them to help people on the spectrum. Because whenever we look at behavioral and when we look at learning, we always tend to highlight the child or the adult as opposed to maybe it's the strategies that we're using. Because on the cover is a little guy, and he's very cute. He's looking through a hole. And what's interesting is there's, I think, approximately 10 chapters of the book, and each chapter starts out with the same type of circle with a little face looking out. And that little face is in the book of a kid that I've worked with, because my editor asked me to send in a bunch of pictures, and I did. And I was hoping that one of them would make the cover, but she called me and said, listen, you know, Jim, we went through these, you know, can you get another one, you know, of a kid with much higher resolution, because these are not going to pop on the cover. And we went through a couple different edits, and we couldn't just get a picture that was really going to pop like they wanted it. So they went out and they said, do you mind if we go just buy a picture from somebody? And I'm like, no, sure. So they go out and they buy it, and we look at the cover, and everybody decides, okay, this is great. We're going to go with it. So we go with it. And I guess a year later, I got an email. And in the reference box, the email said, you don't know me, but. Now, how many of you out there would actually open that email? Most people wouldn't. But I tend to be a little obsessive compulsive, so I'm like, I was very curious by it. So I opened up the email, and it said, you know, you don't know me, but my son is on the cover of your book. I was in Barnes & Noble's. I was looking around, and I just looked over, and I said, wow, look, there's my son. And she came over, and she goes, I'm a freelance photographer. I sell pictures for a living. I sell them to online sites, and then people buy them. And when he was born, you know, we took a ton of pictures of him and, you know, sold them to a variety of places. And this is the first time I saw his picture on your book. And he looks amazing. You know, the book looks really good. And he goes, and she goes, and just yesterday he was diagnosed with autism. The impact of this disability and this, you know, this population is just so far beyond, I think, what we're really understanding at this point. And I'm glad that these webinars are out there, and I'm glad that people are calling in and people are listening to, you know, a variety of different people giving information on what this thing called autism is, because I think for a lot of people it's defined differently, but there are some commonalities, and it all starts with early intervention. And we know for a fact that, and the research is very clear, the earlier we diagnose the child, the better the quantity and quality of the services the child receives, the better their prognosis is long term. And there's a lot of a body of research out there and evidence that actually proves that. And it was interesting because at the National Autism Conference this year, which we held in Orlando, Florida, We had the great fortune of having Dr. Omni Klin, who used to be with the Yale Child Project from Yale University, but now is with the Marcus Center in Atlanta, Georgia, and he was our keynote talking about early intervention. And I was amazed because initially, and I thought it was far younger than this, he came out with some statistics, and he said that the average age of diagnosis of a child on the spectrum was 3.5. And it was even higher for minority families because it was 4.5. And I thought that we were way earlier than that because, again, he had some very specific information on some of the studies that they're doing, that they're able to see some kids with some motoric issues or other global delays that they were able to do some therapy with early, and they were seeing some remarkable gains in joint attention, and that's, I think, a study that's going to come out probably in the next year from the Marcus Center. But they were talking very specifically about the fact that, again, the earlier we catch it, the better the quantity and quality of those services, the better their prognosis is going to be long-term. And it's just, it amazed me that the numbers were that high, because when you look at it, early intervention is 0 to 3. And what happens a lot of times in the 0 to 3 range is that these kids don't get picked up or diagnosed or looked at until 2.5, you know, or a little older. And then by the time you get all the evaluations and the team together, the kid turns 3, and then when they turn 3, they go into the school system. At least in the States they do, you know, so they become school-aged. And then so they never really get into the early intervention system, and especially at 3.5. And that tends also to be skewed a little bit, I think, by some of our kids, you know, with Asperger syndrome, because those kids sometimes have a variety of different, for lack of a better term, labels, you know, than Asperger's earlier on, you know, variety, sometimes ADHD, you know, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder or others. And especially our girls, because our girls tend to be much more difficult to diagnose with Asperger's. And that comes strictly down to the fact that, you know, they tend to be much more social. And as soon as you see them be social, the first thing people check off their list is, well, it couldn't be autism, because they look at it strictly, in a lot of cases, as a social disorder, as opposed to, you know, what the quality and, you know, what the how the social skills are delivered by the individual child. So having said all that, what I'm going to talk about is earlier intervention in autism, but again, even though earlier intervention is 0 to 3, a lot of the things, if not all of the things that I'm going to talk about, would be applicable for any child at any age with an autism spectrum disorder, because the first two chapters of the book really just talk about specifics to early intervention and what the system looks like, but the last eight chapters really are about strategies. They're about key issues that the children might have, like sleep issues, eating issues, toileting issues, and then also goes heavily into curriculum and also into behavior management. Because a lot of times our kids have some issues around maintaining, you know, appropriate behavior in certain situations. And again, that's always one of the things that I think challenge most people are some of the behavioral disorders that they will see in our kids. The most important part and the legal part of any child's lifespan are always going to be these things that we call the plan. And under 3, it happens to be an individualized family service plan, or an IFSP. Over 3 to age 21, some states 22, if appropriate, it's called an IEP, so an individual education plan. And then over 21 or 22, it's an IHP in most places, which is an individual habilitation plan. These plans are the legal document that drives the service for the child. And it's imperative that during this process, families have teams and people they trust and people who have knowledge of autism and people who are part of the system together to develop what this plan looks like. Because even though I see a lot of two and a half year old young people on the spectrum and develop home programs for them or school programs or combination programs, I have to look at them as a 21-year-old adult. I have to see into their future or try to look into what does this path look like for this child? Where are we going to head? Now, as the child gets older, they're going to bring a ton of strengths to the table, and they're also going to have some challenges, and that's where we need to work through that plan. But we need to map that plan out, because the reality of the whole process is that the money is in the 3 to 21 range, because that's where entitlement comes in. Yes, there is money 0 to 3 in the early intervention system, but it's not a lot. And even though by law the early intervention program is determined by the need of the child, I've been to many, many states where you see, you know, a kid that has autism, you can just see a generic program. You can see the same amount of hours for each kid, and each kid is not the same. I mean, Stephen Shore, who is an individual on the spectrum who I happen to be very good friends with, who's a professor at Adelphi University and has sat on the Autism Society of America's national board for a number of years and is a prolific writer and speaker. He starts all of his talks off with, if you know one person with autism, you know one person with autism. And that's how very different, you know, our kids can be. And I think as part of that, then each kid couldn't possibly have the same need under three. Yet most of the programs are very generic. So it's really helping the family to navigate and get the appropriate services that the child needs based on the child's need, not based on what monies are out there or what services can be provided. But that tends to happen in the 0 to 3 range. 3 to 21, you know, started off with, you know, Public Law 94-142, which is now IDEIA, the Individual Education of Individuals with Disabilities Act or Improvement Act. And that is the mandate, you know, for services. And that's got to make that document ironclad. That's exactly what that child needs. So it's critical at the early ages that that document has no holes in it and that document is very tight in looking at and describing the child's strengths, looking at the child's challenges, and mediating those challenges through what the most appropriate program is going to be. And again, that's going to be different for every child. Because when you look at the IFSP, they look at a variety of things, and the first thing is the intensity of the engagement. And I think this is probably the most important part, because I think people might have heard, you know, the window of opportunity for children, that it's, you know, people usually define that as, you know, 2 to about 5. Well, again, the research is pretty clear. We know that our kids, you know, grow. We know that our kids learn, and we know that the brain continues to develop. And we also know that, you know, through some of the research that, you know, even adults still continue to learn new skills and develop new skills. So even though that we call it that window of opportunity, but when you look at that window, I think you need to more look at neurologically what goes on for the child. Because at those ages, the reason that there are so many more gains, I think, is more in the plasticity of the brain, because as the brain becomes, you know, and again, for lack of a better term, hardwired over time, as the younger ages, that the brain is so much more, has so much more plasticity that you're able to teach those skills. And I think that's why the earlier we can start the therapy, the better off the child's going to be. because of that part of it. And the intensity of the engagement really looks at, you know, keeping the kid in the here and now. And that can be done by a variety of people. I think when some families look at it, they think, you know, when you first saw the Catherine Maurice book, which talks about 40 hours, you know, of discrete trial or 40 hours of therapy, that therapy can be done, you know, by almost anybody. And a lot of times it the family is the first teacher. And not that we wouldn't have a variety of different people in the house, but again, the family can, you know, be the one that's there and if given the right training and the right tools, can keep that kid in the here and now so that intensity of engagement maintains itself over a long period of time. Because you can have speech people, you can have an occupational therapist, you might even have a physical therapist, maybe a behaviorist. However, those times are limited, and the family is there a majority of the time. So I think really, you know, keeping that kid in that here and now for the long period of time really helped to initiate and maintain that intensity of engagement. And it's got to be individualized. And every family is going to be different. Every child is going to be different. Every situation is going to be different. And every, you know, culture is going to be different. So when we're looking at individualization, we really have to take into account all of those differences and help the family and the child by not using a cookie-cutter approach, because a cookie-cutter approach is not going to be effective with this population. And in early intervention, which is always amazing to me, because the families I work with, the first thing I work with them on is establishing a relationship with their school district, because, you know, we talk heavily in the early intervention system about family involvement. And I think it's the core and the crux of everything that we do is to empower the family to be the keeper of the knowledge on that child, because they're the one that's with them, you know, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. I mean, they know that child better than anybody. And I think in the early intervention system, we push that family involvement piece, but we don't help to foster that into the school-aged piece. Because once we get into school-aged, and the law is pretty clear, it's called pedagogy, which is the way kids learn or the way kids are taught, the school district is totally in charge of that. And we go from a system where we talk about, you know, the parent needs to be the keeper, the parent needs to have the information, the parent needs to be the one, then we go into three, and all of a sudden it shifts dramatically. Because now the school is like, okay, we'll take over from here. And it's just such a disconnect to me. So a lot of the things that I do, you know, with my families are really around balancing that or bridging that gap between the early intervention system and the school age system so that it's, number one, not overwhelming to the family, you know, and two, that there's a collective thought process as to how to develop what this IEP is going to look like and how it's going to drive the services, because, you know, the family, again, is the one that's going to be there and is going to need to follow through on a lot of the things that, you know, we're going to be doing in the school program or in the early intervention program. And then systematic and planned teaching, and we're going to talk a lot more about that in a little bit, but it's got to be specific, and it's got to be very systematic, and you do need to use a specialized curriculum. And it doesn't have to cost you anything. You just need to understand how to modify. And I think for most of us who had, you know, formal special ed trainings, we understand that, you know, most of our job in special ed was, you know, while we were in school, was about modifying. It was about taking things and making them work and helping the child to understand them. And over the years, the one thing that we know that we can do is teach a lot of skills to our kids. The problem is generalizing those skills and maintaining them. And I think that we haven't done a very good job of that, because I think we've understood certain technologies, but we haven't advanced them far enough. And then they have to have objective measurements of progress. And I think people tend to run screaming into the night on this one, because, you know, whenever I'm around, you know, I walk in and I'm looking for specific data. I don't want to hear I thought. I don't want to hear it looks like. I don't want to hear it appears. One of my favorite terms is emerging. I don't get that term a lot. I don't know what it means to emerge. And I'm really looking at what the hardcore data says as to the child's progress. And that can only be done if you have very objective measurements of progress. And that means that in your goal areas, that would be, you know, for a little guy or a little girl, you know, it might be pre-academic skills, it might be speech and language, you know, skills, it might be social skills, and those are your goal areas. And then based on those goal areas, you have specific goals and objectives that help to target that. So you're looking at, okay, if the deficit area is in speech and language, you know, and that's a goal area, then what is exactly are the challenges? Because whatever the challenges are, we better have goals, or I'm sorry, we better have objectives that are going to meet to remediate that issue. And I think a lot of times we don't marry those terms, or we don't look at them to match them up and ask the right questions. And a lot of my working with a lot of my families, we really look at that opportunity to just, you know, really ask those questions on, okay, how does, if this is what the testing is saying my child, you know, has an issue with, then what are we going to do to teach that? And, you know, the professional should be able to tell you. I mean, we should have real measurable goals and objectives to do that. And then there really needs to be opportunities for inclusion with typically developing peers in natural settings. Our kids don't always start out modeling really well, but once taught the skill, their joint attention gets that much better. And the little ones especially, the things that I've seen, and you'll have this on tape, and you don't have to run back to people and say, Jim Ball says don't teach kids because it's not what I'm saying. But I look for three basic skills coming out of a preschool program. And if our kids have those three basic skills, their success for quality of life long term is going to be that much more enhanced. And the number one is toilet train. I don't know how good your adult services system is in the area that you live in, but I do know that here in New Jersey, it's not that good. And if the child's not toilet trained or at least schedule trained, you've now curtailed your options for that child. And it just breaks my heart when I see more and more kids. And I've seen, like, just last week I was in several different schools in several different states, and I was in middle school classrooms, and I saw kids that still haven't been toilet trained. And that just, I don't get that, because I think at the younger ages it is, you know, there's never been a kid that I haven't met, you know, that I've worked with that I haven't been able to at least schedule train to understand that. And to me, it's just, you know, it's one of those life skills that I think, you know, long-term is going to improve their quality of life. The other one is, which goes with the opportunities for inclusion with typically developing peers, is really that joint attention. And when I say joint attention, I mean that ability to look at another, engage them in what you're looking at or what you're doing, and then have a reciprocation with it. And especially for our little ones, having them understand to look at other kids when other kids are talking, or look at other kids when other kids are playing. Because a lot of times our kids don't like to do those things. But I think through repetition, if we do it often enough, we get our kids used to doing those things, and they want to be involved in it. And then they bring those barriers down. And if you've ever heard or had the opportunity or the good fortune to hear Temple Grandin talk, which I have on numerous occasions, she really, you know, talks about the fact that, you know, for her and in her early life, it was all about turn-taking, and how her mother made her do that with her siblings. And that really, you know, she really credits that to a lot of things, you know, in her early development. And that peace, to me, I think is one of the most important. And then the last, and I think one of the most effective, is teaching them a scheduling system, and whatever that scheduling system is. I mean, it could be a variety of different things, again, depending on the strengths and the challenges of the child. It's always going to be different, but I think they all need, as we do, you know, a scheduling system, because long term, I mean, a lot of the kids that I've worked with high-functioning autism or Asperger's, and right now I've got the great fortune of having four of the kids that I've worked with all in college, and they're all very different young men, and they were all, in middle school, just organizational nightmares. And for kids that were compulsive about certain things and hyper-focused on certain things of interest, they didn't have really good organizational systems or organizational skills in order to complete a lot of things. So we had to develop those, and we started very, very early because I think that also builds an expectation, and it also lets the child know, you know, this is what we're going to do, this is how we're going to do it, this is the sequence. And I think that's a very critical piece to everything that we do. And then again, I mean, the earliest possible start to intervention is probably by far the best, because the earlier we start, the better the quantity and quality, the better the prognosis. I think that's pretty clear through a lot of the research. Now, with families, you know, in this system, they've got to navigate so many different things. And there are so many different programs out there. And this is just a short list of the things that I've looked at, and there's so many more. And you can see, you know, applied behavior analysis, the Greenspan method, the Teach method, sensory integration, RDI. That's the relationship development one by Dr. Stephen Goodstein. And then the Miller method, and you have the Sunrise program and the BAN protocol and hippotherapy. And then, you know, I don't have occupational therapy on there or speech therapy on there and a variety of others. And how do you pick this program? How do you pick, you know, what's going to be the most appropriate for your child when you just get an initial diagnosis? You might have heard of this thing called autism, but you don't know what this thing is. And again, it's going to manifest itself very differently in every child. How is it doing it in my kid? And teasing out what's neurotypical development. And when I use the word neurotypical, I mean normal, for whatever that means. I mean, it's normal, but whatever normal means. But, you know, how do I tease out what's neurotypical development as opposed to what this thing, you know, called autism is? And families, you know, struggle with that. And I work with my families because, again, every day there's something new coming down the road. Some have been very, very successful. But how do you know it's right for your kid? How do you know it's right for your family? And really understanding what all those different methodologies look like. So what I did is I sat down and I looked at all the different ones that were out there, all the different methodologies, and I came up with 7 effective strategies. And this could be, it says the perfect DI program, but it could be the perfect school-age program, it could be the perfect middle school class, it could be perfect high school class, it could be perfect, you know, adult work environment, it could be the perfect inclusionary opportunity. But I came up with 7 strategies that were pretty consistent throughout all of the different methodologies. So it would just stand to reason that if everybody's using these 7 strategies, that they're probably the most effective for a majority of our young people on the spectrum. And the first one is repetition. You know, we do know that our kids learn through repetition. It's interesting. I don't know how many of you, again, have seen Temple Grandin, but she was the first person in my career when I was a teacher aide in a classroom some 25, you know, years ago, when I first got hired, working with 2 kids again, that I got the opportunity to speak. And now, just I guess last week, I was with her in San Antonio, Texas, and her and I spoke together. So our careers are sort of paralleled a little bit. But it's interesting that over that time, she is a much different presenter today than she was back then. She's much different with the crowd today than she was back then. She's less stilted than she was back then. Back then, sensory issues, she heard sounds or people were in the audience chattering. I remember one time a guy had a beeper and it went off, and that just drove her crazy because she started out her talk with turn everything off, and that's the rule, so turn everything off. And she just could not get over the fact that he just didn't turn it off when she asked him to. And it was just interesting that now she just, anything could be happening in the audience and she'll incorporate it into her talk. And when talking to her, you know, she's always told me, you know, Jim, it's, you know, it's more about doing it. It's getting out there and doing it over and over again, you know, getting used to it. And I think when that happens, you know, because a lot of times our kids have a lot of anxiety over a variety of things, and if you get them into situations where you do things over and over and over again, they get used to it. And once they get used to it, they start to incorporate it. And then their anxiety goes down, so that then they become more, they risk a little bit more, and then it almost becomes a snowball. Then they'll try more things. So they'll take some risks. And I always love to see when our kids get to those points where we've done the repetition enough where all of a sudden you can see it's just clicking. It's just, wow, okay, now they're enjoying it and they're figuring it out and they like what's going on, where before they wouldn't allow themselves that opportunity to actually enjoy that activity or whatever it was. And I always like to look at repetition, too, through, because I come from an athletic background, through sport. Because if you have a child that's an athlete, if you're a former athlete, you know, or you've ever seen, you know, athletes train, it's pretty much the same way we teach kids on the spectrum. Because if you have a basketball player and they've made one layup and they show they're proficient at a skill, so they're proficient at layups, that doesn't mean that you're going to stop there. That doesn't mean that they don't shoot tens of thousands of layups to get better at it. And why do we do it over and over and over again? It's the same with a quarterback. If they've thrown a pass and they've thrown it once and they, you know, completed it and everything's great, the perfect spiral and everything was good, we don't stop there. They throw passes over and over and over again. And the better coaches are the ones that can do these skills but do them in a variety of different ways so the kids don't get bored, but they're still practicing the same skill. And the reason we do it is because in that moment of high stress, the game, the skill comes naturally. They don't think about it. Because if, you know, Michael Jordan was coming down the court and he thought to himself, I'm going to go to midcourt, I'm going to cross over dribble, I'm going to go to the lane and I'm going to take off and I'm going to slam over everybody. Well, if he thought all that out, while he's thinking it coming down the court, what would happen is the other team would have stolen the ball and been down the court before he even could even start to motor plan it. So when he does those things, those amazing things, or did those amazing things when he was a player, it was all about the practice. And they always talk about the better players in games are those that are the best practice players because they get used to doing it and it becomes natural. And that's where we don't use enough of the repetition, especially in teaching kids on the spectrum social skills, because we don't set up enough real-life situations for them to use these skills. We just put them in context or in a normal setting or a normalized setting and throw them in there and say, okay, we're going to use the skill, and we wonder why it goes woefully wrong a lot of the time. And, you know, Michelle Garcia Winner and social thinking really looks at, you know, instead of just teaching the skill, you've got to integrate it into so many different things. And through the use of the repetition, that actually is what takes place. Because once something creeps in and the anxiety starts to go up, the skill isn't always as good. And that's really evident when you look at, like, you know, there's 10 seconds left in the game and your team is down by, you know, a point. And you get your team in field goal range, and right when you're getting ready to kick the ball, the other team does what? They call a timeout. Once the timeout's called, why do they do that? Why do they call the timeout? Well, they call the timeout to, and you can use whatever term you like, but to ice the kicker. And by icing the kicker, you're getting that kicker to think about what he's going to do. And by it creeping in, he may miss it because he gets anxious because he's got to perform the skill while he's thinking about it. And that's what, you know, a lot of the better athletes are the ones that are just so mentally tough that it just doesn't, you know, it just doesn't bother them. They'll go up and they kick it and it's good because they've done the work prior and they've done the repetition. And a lot of times, you know, with our kids, it goes woefully wrong because they haven't had that opportunity through the repetition. And that also can be done at skill level when we're teaching academics or any of the curriculum. The second one is shaping. And shaping, and it always goes along with chaining, but shaping and chaining, and that'll be the third one, but I'll start with shaping. Shaping is when you take a complex behavior and you break it down and teach smaller components up to the whole in order to achieve the overall behavior that you're looking for. And what I mean by that, for an example, would be if I want the child to say mommy, and the child will at least go initially, I would heavily reinforce the with that child, and then model the rest and say to the child, oh, that's beautiful saying mommy. And then after I get them saying the with pretty consistently, I would then only accept ma and then mommy. So you add to that behavior. So you're only going to take smaller increments and build up to what that overall whole is. I was just working with a little girl the other day, and the speech therapist, we were doing one-step directions with her, so she would respond to one-step directives. And cute as could be, and she was about, I guess, three and a half, and her to die for, and we'll talk about reinforcement in a second, but then I call it her to die for, or the kids to die for, was Skittles. She just loved Skittles. And when we were teaching the come here, because that was the directive that the person was using, initially she wouldn't move, and she would, it was so cute because the teacher, the speech therapist, left the Skittle on the desk. And when she said, come here, the girl just took her chair and scooted it all the way over and took the Skittle. So I thought that was masterful that she figured that out quickly. But as I was watching her, her little, butt would come off the chair for a split second when the speech therapist was saying, come here. And what I said is, as soon as you see any movement on her, give her the reinforcer that to die for immediately, and then shape the rest by showing her what you want her to do. And then within, I think, maybe, 5 or 10 times doing it, she was understanding what that expectation was by taking that preliminary behavior of her just leaning out of the chair all the way up through going to the speech therapist. So what you're going to be doing is taking those approximations of behaviors and then shaping them or reinforcing them up into the whole, and that's what shaping is. Chaining is when you take a very complex behavior, like, let's say, and these normally are around personal care skills, domestic skills, but mainly around the personal care area is like toothbrushing. You take that long chain of toothbrushing, which could be, for some people 14 or 15 steps, and you break it down into all of those 15 steps, and you teach each step, and as the child masters each step, you add the next step so that you teach the chain all as one towards the end. And also, a lot of times with some kids, you can do, what they would call whole task presentation, and what that means is you would go in and just show the kid exactly what to do to brush your teeth and all the different steps, and some of our kids will get it beautifully. So you can do, your first opportunity at teaching it could be done that way. However, most of our kids get caught somewhere or forget steps, and that's when we really need to go back to the basics and teach it up to the whole. And how you would do something like that is you would say to the child, okay, brush your teeth, and if they happen to be in the bathroom, that wouldn't be the first step, because a lot of times the first step might be going to the bathroom, but if we're already in the bathroom and we say brush your teeth, the kid picks up the toothbrush and then he just stands there. But we know he at least knows what the toothbrush is. So then the next step might be to get the toothpaste. So we would non-verbally prompt the child to get the toothpaste, and then at that point reinforce the child and say, what a beautiful job brushing your teeth. And then we would do the rest of the steps with that child non-verbally and not let them make mistakes in that chain. And then after we get two times in a row of independence at that step of, in this particular case, of getting the toothpaste, then we would move to the next step, which would then be removing the cap from the toothpaste. And then after we get that for two times independent, then we would move to the next. So we want to build the skill as we go along. And if you do it correctly and do it right, then that child is going to have that whole chain. So when you say brush your teeth, the kid's going to go in and they're going to do from beginning to end the entire chain. And a lot of times, you know, what ends up happening with a lot of our kids is they get lost in those different steps because we used a lot of verbal language, which then, you know, and I'm not one to sit here and tell you that all kids on the spectrum are visual learners because they're not. The research is pretty clear. If you look at it, they are auditory learners, but visuals do help them to become independent at skills. So, and also an alternate way to use visuals is also in learning, because then they have another opportunity or another avenue, because, you know, everybody learns differently. Because I know for a fact for me, I'm much more of a hands-on learner. I mean, I couldn't read the book and then go on and try to do something online if it's like, you know, build a website. You know, I would just go on, open the website up, and start trying things. And if I failed, then I would say, okay, don't go back to that. And that's called contingency management, you know, ways of doing things, because, you know, you're not reinforced, so you don't go back and do it again. It's the same way, you know, if I put a PowerPoint together. I mean, I didn't read how to do a PowerPoint or take a class on how to do it. I just went on and figured it out. And when I was figuring it out, if things worked, then that was great. I was reinforced for it, so then I would do it again. If it wasn't, then I didn't go back to it. So with the kids, a lot of times, you know, you might want to also use visuals in some of your chaining activities, because if, you know, take for instance toothbrushing, if the toothbrushing sequence is in the bathroom, then they've got a visual to go back to, you know, to see, oh, okay, that step or this step, or it also can be better prompted. Chaining can also be used in behavior management, because a lot of times for certain activities, like let's say group activities or some of the related services, because some of our kids have, you know, problems, you know, maintaining themselves in a music or art or gym or even some, you know, some other opportunities, what we might do is backward or forward chain them into those activities. And what I mean by that is, if it's a gym class, let's say, for instance, I have this little guy I'm working with in West Virginia, and we were trying to get him into gym. And when we first started, they were putting him in there the whole time, and he was just wreaking havoc. And for himself, you know, he just wasn't being successful. And the aide was fairly well trained, but when we went in, we talked about the opportunities to get him successful, and we forward chained him into gym, which meant in the beginning he would go in and all the kids would go to their spot and he would go to his spot, and then he would wait till the teacher took attendance, and then the teacher would give what they were going to do. And in the beginning, before he got, you know, to have some of the escape behaviors that he was using to remove himself, we would get him out after he had a very successful experience. And within a month and a half period, we were able to go from 5 minutes, you know, to the entire 45-minute gym class by building it back in and reducing some of those escape behaviors, and that was an easy way to chain him into that environment. Also done it in had a young man who he had a lot of vocalizations, so he would let out this yell every once in a while. And he happened to do it in church once, and it reverberated, and he just loved it. So he would do it a lot, and he was ready to get one of his sacraments, and he wasn't going to be able to maintain himself in there if he was going to be doing the vocalization. So what we did is we ended up backward chaining him into church. And the repetition was that they had a Saturday and then a Sunday, two masses, so there were three masses we could do every week, and it took us about 8 months, but mom would go in, she'd get a pew, she'd sit down, she'd wait, and then in the last 5 minutes, we'd get him in, and we found, again, his to-die-for reinforcer, which was Chiclets, and if you remember Chiclets, they also made those real little ones, and he just loved those real little ones, and he would get one if he sat there quietly. And what we did is, over that 8 month period, we were able to get him through the entire hour and a half to get his sacrament. And without any of the vocalization. So again, chaining can be used also in behavior management. Number four is probably a topic that could be its own 2-hour webinar. A reinforcement, I think, by far, is the most important thing that we're going to look at, and also is probably the least assessed and needs to probably be the most assessed. Because, again, everybody is motivated by different things. Everybody on this phone call is motivated by different things. We just know how to access those things more effectively and know how to get our reinforcement when we need it, or know how to access it in different environments. And, again, you know, we all do certain things to achieve certain things for different motivations. And bottom line with all of the kids on the spectrum is really getting into figuring out what those motivations are. And they might not be the same as ours, and they may not even be close to the same as ours, but we need to find out and figure it out, and we need to find out what makes them tick. And in a lot of cases, what's so great about the kids that are able to articulate it is just ask them. I mean, they'll give you some very clear, reinforcers. And I always like, and I stole this from Ann Holmes, who is the CCO right now of the Eden Family Services. When I was there, she was a speech and language pathologist, and she called them the to die for. Because if you're going to really make great behavioral change, you've got to have that to die for. And if you're going to do any of the major skills like toilet training and other things, you really need to have those to die for. And not that you're not going to phase them out, because absolutely we're going to phase them out, because I think the one thing about, especially about applied behavior analysis, is that people who don't understand the science of it really don't understand the generalization and maintenance of skills and how to move kids quickly from that one-to-one reinforcement into more random reinforcement. And we know for a fact that the more random the reinforcer is, if it's worth it, that the more we're going to maintain behavior that we're looking for, especially if we defined it in the child. Because if the child receives something after every single thing they do, then they're going to expect that. And if we've done that for a long period of time and then try to change it, the behavior that we're looking for goes away immediately. If we can maintain it over time and the child only gets that reinforcer every so often, then we're going to maintain it for longer periods of time. And I'll give you an example of that in a second, but I do want to say that a lot of people will say, well, then you're just bribing the kid. Well, we're not bribing. Bribing is very different, and what I always love about kids on the spectrum is that in some areas they are so much brighter than their neurotypical counterparts, and this is one of those areas, because you can bribe a neurotypical kid, but you can't bribe a kid on the spectrum, because bribery comes first. So whatever it is you're using comes first in bribery. So you would say to the child, the neurotypical child, here's $5, go mow the lawn. So the kid gets the $5 and the kid goes and mows the lawn. If I was working with a kid on the spectrum and I said, here's a Skittle, gave him the Skittle and then asked them to do something for me, they're not going to do it for me. They already have the Skittle. They're way beyond that. They're way too smart for that. So with the neurotypical kids, you give that bribe first. But with our kids, it's about reinforcement. It's about the reinforcement of skills. It's about the reinforcement of behavior that you're looking for. Let me give you an example of what I mean by that more systematic approach, of reinforcement. Because years ago, I used to be a big fan of, token boards and sticker charts and all those, real systematic ways of doing reinforcement. But I've gotten beyond that. Not that I wouldn't use them, because I absolutely would. But I've gotten beyond those and made them more random because, again, you've got these people, these little people who are a little bit compulsive in nature. And again, if you've watched them, they're very compulsive about certain things. And they get so into what that system is that when you go to change it, again, the behavior falls like a stone because you're changing something that's been in place for a long time. Because people just don't understand again, the science of applied behavior analysis will give that, you know, whatever that reinforcer is after everything that they do, and don't fade it fast enough, and then the kid just gets used to it, and then we've set up a system. And who do we blame? We go back and we blame the kid. Oh, because don't you know that kid's on the spectrum? You know, they don't you know, generalize real well, and they don't maintain things. Well, that's not their fault. That's our fault. We've taught that. And I've worked really hard with a lot of the young people that I'm working with right now on getting to that random system. And I think this will make better sense through an example. You're in your place of business, and you walk into the staff lounge. You trip on the carpet, and you fall into the soda machine. When you fall into the soda machine, you hit it once with your fist, and out comes the soda. It's your brand and your flavor. You look around, there's nobody there, you drink it. Next day you go in, you look around, there's nobody in the staff lounge, you hit the machine once, out comes the soda, your brand and your flavor. You look around, again, there's nobody there, so you drink it. Come back in third day, for a month, you go in, you hit the machine once, out comes the soda, there's nobody around, you drink it. Unbeknownst to you, they come in and they fix the machine. You hit the machine once, nothing comes out. If you're like me, you might hit it again because you didn't think you hit it hard enough. But after that, what have you been conditioned during that month? One hit gets me one soda. So after maybe about the second, if you do that, that hitting behavior of hitting the machine to get a soda goes away immediately. So the behavior that you were trying to maintain is extinguished immediately. Different set of circumstances, you know, same type of scenario. You walk into your place of business, you trip on the carpet, and you fall into the soda machine, and you kick it twice and hit it twice, and out comes the soda. It's your brand and your flavor. There's nobody around. You drink it. Next day you come in, you kick it 5 times and punch it 10 times. And there's nobody around. Now comes your soda. You drink it. For that month, you kick it anywhere between 40 and 50 times, and you punch it anywhere between 30 and 40 times. Out comes the soda. It's your brand and your flavor. You drink it. Unbeknownst to you, they come in and they fix the machine. When you go back in the next day, how many times might you kick it or punch it? You don't know. So you may do it a lot, which is going to maintain those two behaviors over a period of time. And if the reinforcer is worth it, the soda, you're going to do it even longer. And as you're doing it, also comes in quantity and quality of reinforcement. Because as you're hitting and kicking it to try to get the soda, now you're doing a little bit of exercise, which means you're sweating. If you start to sweat, then you're going to get thirstier. Now the soda has more value. And these are all the different things that come into play when you're looking at reinforcement. But the critical part is to come up with the system or systems that are the most appropriate for the individual, and always, always be assessing motivation. Always trying to figure out the whys, you know, with the kids. The next one is play. And play skills are critical to any young child, because that's how they're going to interact with their peer groups. And understand that there's a huge difference between boys and girls. And regardless if they're on the spectrum or not, they're very different. And just by gender, women are going to be much more social than men. And neurotypical are the same. So, I mean, neurotypically, you know, men are much, much different than women. And also, women are much more social creatures than men are. And in the play, if I can tell you anything during the play, especially for your boys, teach them to play with the material correctly. Because if you watch neurotypical boys play, they play very different than girls. Because if you have a girl on a play date, so the girls have a play date, those girls are attached at the hip, and they are constant talking the whole time, back and forth. You never bring a third girl in, but, you know, two girls together, that they're attached. You do two boys on a play date, I mean, even to this day, I'll come home and my youngest, who's 12, you know, I'll come in, I'm like, hey, you know, Zach, how you doing? He's like, oh, good. I'm like, what's going on? He goes, oh, Jonathan's here. I'm like, oh, okay, you know, where's Jonathan? And I'll look around, and Jonathan's You know, his buddy is up in his room playing, and then they'll gravitate to each other and play a little bit like online or on a video game, and then they'll break off again because boys don't play the same way. And it's so interesting because I'll watch, you know, us trying to integrate our boys into a variety of different settings. And when I go in, it's the skill level of not understanding the toys appropriately as opposed to anything else. Because when you watch, again, the neurotypical boys play, you know, I'll watch a bunch of seven-year-old boys play, and they'll have all the same dinosaurs. But when you listen to each individual kid, they're playing very, very different games. And I can't tell you how many times I've heard in a preschool setting, the neurotypical boys go, "Does he have to play? He's not playing with them right. He's not building right." You know, it's not about what they're doing. It's about what they're doing with the material. So I really work on getting, you know, the kids to play with the materials appropriately and do a lot around video modeling. Video modeling is one of those core evidence-based strategies. And, you know, I do a lot around taking video of neurotypical kids playing with the toys that might be in the environment the child is going to go into, and then I'll have them in that environment look at the video first and play with the toys while watching the video, and you'll see the kids, they'll model so much better and more effectively when they do it that way, and then move it towards them then integrating it, you know, when they're doing it with the other kids. But play activities, especially at this age, are going to be very, very critical. Extinction is by far your most important behavior management strategy, by far. And we are a society that is quick to criticize. We are quick to jump on kids. And extinction, and understand that there's a, you know, what extinction is, because extinction isn't ignoring the child. It's ignoring the behavior of the child. So the child could be having a meltdown. The child could be, you know, doing a variety of things. And what we're going to do is we're going to ignore all those behaviors that are occurring, and we're going to keep asking the kid to do things. We're going to prompt them through doing those things, and we're going to reward them, just like, you know, the time, you know, you say to the kid, you know, "Billy, come here," and the kid runs to the other side of the room, and you get up, you walk over, you don't give them any eye contact, and you start to prompt them back over to where they had ran from, and they're trying to throw themselves on the floor, they might be crying, you keep walking them over. When you get there, you look at them and say, "Oh, what a good boy listening, Billy, you're such a big guy, it was great listening," because you're ignoring all those behaviors that were occurring, and you're just reinforcing what it is you want to see. And if you do that through repetition, then the child's going to understand what the expectation is of the language that you're using. And in extinction, as long as the kid isn't killing himself or anybody else, or herself or anybody else, ignore it. Don't bring any attention to it. Redirect it. But we want to bring so much to that, and then we might inadvertently reinforce it. We might inadvertently let a kid escape from something, and then they learn that those behaviors are going to be so much more effective for them than anything else that they're going to be able to do. And it's, again, critical for us to be able to shape other behaviors, and if we're constantly bringing up the negative, then we're not going to be able to shape the other behaviors, because in behavior management especially, and if you have questions out there about behavior management, I'm going to give you a real brief rundown on the things that you need to look for now, because it would be, you know, actually unethical for me to speak specifically. I don't know, you know, your particular child or a child you work with, but in this particular case, what you need to be looking for are the triggers as to why they occur and what is its function. Why does the child do it? And there is a function for every behavior. And that's what makes autism very different than all the other disability groups. Our kids do it for probably three, maybe four basic reasons. They do it to gain attention, they do it to avoid something, to escape something, and to self-stimulate. And those are the basics. And when you figure out why, the why is what gives you the programming to come up with a functional equivalent. And what I mean by that is, if I don't take the place of whatever the kid is using the behavior for, and I just get rid of it somehow, they're going to come up with something else. Do you ever play whack-a-mole? If you've ever played whack-a-mole, you know, you pop one down, another one pops up. So for kids that go through cycles or cycle behavior, or you see one behavior for a while and then they stop it and they start another one, they're probably, you know, you haven't, and I like to use the term, you haven't scratched the itch. The itch is still there, and you've got to figure out a way to scratch the itch. And you got to give that kid, it's normally going to be something communicative, a way to get that same need or want met in a different way that's much more appropriate. Because if you don't, the kid is going to still continue to utilize that behavior because it's much more effective. And that's going to be the basics of everything you do. And the number one thing is to find out and to really, you know, when anybody, you know, uses the term, or if you've heard the term functional behavior assessment, in functional behavior assessment, you're trying to find out the function of the behavior so that you can design the program not to address the negative behavior, because, yeah, we probably will address that negative behavior some way, but and most people think it's about addressing the negative behavior. It's much more about teaching the alternative skill. Because if you're not teaching the alternative skill, the child's going to replace it themselves. And that's what I think the most interesting part of functional behavior assessment is, especially that I do a lot of my practice on that, is really figuring out the whys. And the tougher kids are the ones that use it for a variety of things, so you have to tease those kinds of things out. But remember that, especially with the little ones, unless they're killing themselves or somebody else, ignore it and redirect it, and then address the appropriate things you want to see the kid do. Don't constantly bring that negative up all the time. And then the last one is rapport building and behavioral momentum. And just getting to know the kid, getting to know what makes the kid tick, getting to know what their favorite things are, I think are all that part of that rapport building. Because our kids, you know, they get a sense. I mean, they can sense things. And they know when people are, you know, not on board, and they know when people are on board. And it's interesting because, Nancy and I were having this conversation earlier. I mean, some of the most fascinating people that I've met in my life that I've had, you know, great opportunities to talk to, when I talk about, you know, when they meet people and they build a rapport, how do they figure it out? And they all have very different ways, but they all have the same thing when they say, I just get a feeling, I get a sense. And it's amazing because I think we have that same thing. Because as yourself, when you meet people for the first time or try to establish that rapport with people, you get a sense, too, for how they're interacting and what they're doing. You know, our kids are just at a different level with that. And then behavioral momentum is really looking at starting with something that the kid likes or something that's fun before you get into things that the kid might not like. An example of that would be if you know the kid really likes to draw, before I would do any, you know, paper and pencil task with them, I might let them draw first before I get them to write me a sentence. Because writing me a sentence, you know, is going to be a much tougher skill for them. But if I get them on a good roll where they're doing something fun and then I can bring in maybe some of the more difficult things that they might have issues with or trouble with, that way I can get them on a good, very positive roll first. Because I've heard from so many teachers and even families that their families can tell as soon as the kid gets up what kind of day it's going to be. And teachers are like, as soon as they get off the bus, I can tell. And I'm like, you can change those days. I mean, you really can. You can help them, you know, to start with something that's a lot more exciting, a lot more fun, and then move from there into a variety of different things. And I think that's a lot of fun. I'm trying to figure, you know, what those things look like. Because I think, and this is my final slide, but I think there are must-have components to anything that we're going to do. And by far the most important one is the communication system. And the one thing that I've found consistent in all the different places that I travel to and I go to in my private consulting is people, even at the younger ages, I guess, are waiting for some kind of communication system to develop, and they don't have systems of communications for kids. If the kid shows that they're verbal, then they just do verbal language, and they don't augment that with pictures or objects or other things that the kid might need to really be successful. And, you know, a lot of the kids will develop verbal language, but a lot of them, at least in my career and the ones that I've worked with, don't always use it as functionally as they could, or even to get their needs and wants met effectively, even though they're quite verbal. And I think that building that system, and if you've read the work of Barry Pazant or people like the late Ted Carr, it's really about a system, and it's about having that communication system. And whenever I do any kind of behavior management with families and or with districts that have kids that are in their programs, the first two things I'm looking for is number one, is what their system of communication looks like. And that might be a variety of things. They might have gestures, they might have pictures, they might have some verbal language, they might have an augmentative device, a computer output device. It's going to depend on the kid, but they've got a variety of ways, maybe sign language, a variety of ways to articulate what it is, and also things that staff can prompt. Because a lot of times staff, and families know just by a glance, just by a noise, just by a way a kid moves, what they want or what they don't want, and they can easily prompt and reinforce the use of that system much more effectively, and then it becomes much more universal for the kid. The other thing is an individual reinforcement system. I mean, individual reinforcement systems are by far, again, the most important, because, again, every kid is going to be motivated differently, and assessment is going to be the most important way of figuring all of those different avenues to help those kids. Sensory integration gets a lot of bad press, I think, but more so from the standpoint that it's not as evidence-based as people would like it to be. And so if there's any occupational therapists on the line, please, get your associations and some people to do much more research on occupational therapy, because I fear as IDEIA gets reauthorized, there's a lot of language that's really centering around evidence-based strategies, and I'm not sure how that's going to be translated out. And I don't know how districts and other places are going to react to that kind of language. I know there's a lot of case studies out there, but I think they're looking for more of the evidence-based strategies like the video modeling or the peer-mediated instruction, the applied behavior analysis, those things that have a real strong research base to that, even though we know that there's a lot of different therapies and strategies out there that have been proven, through those case studies and with families to be highly effective. They just don't have that evidence-based quality to them. And it was always funny because when I was a teacher, I always loved speech and OT, but I only loved them for one reason, and that was because they would take a kid out of my class for a half hour, and I could shift and work with the other kids for longer periods of time, so I could shift my schedule around, get a lot of one-on-one in. And I don't know what voodoo they did when they took them out, but when they came back, they were always different. And so I met my first very behavioral OT, and her and I worked very well together, and really taught me, how to integrate activities, how to look at helping the individual child through the use of adaptive techniques in order for them to be successful at a lot of the skill levels that I was trying to teach. I think the integration part especially was the most critical on looking at, how does what you're doing affect the child. And it's so interesting, I think, with the kids that I work with is, if you remember when you were in school, I used to think okay, how is this going to impact my life? How is this subject going to really, you know, make a difference for me? When am I ever going to use this? Did you ever say that to yourself or to your parent or to your teacher? Well, I did that a lot and didn't always get the answer I was looking for, but I think if you're working with a kid on the spectrum, you really need to think that, because how is it going to apply and how is it going to impact their life and how is it really going to make a difference? And if you can't come up with that reason, then I don't know if you can always say that the child is going to understand exactly what the expectation is. So I think, and that I also think comes as part of that sensory integration piece, because you've got to integrate all the different things, because if you teach, if you look at symptomatology and you treat the symptom, you never truly see the whole big picture. And I've heard that many times in my career from a variety of people, but it really impacted me when several years ago, my mother wasn't feeling good and she went to the doctor, and through her symptoms, she was diagnosed with diverticulitis. And I remember sitting at the kitchen table at her house and talking, and her biggest concern was that she couldn't eat Jersey tomatoes anymore because of the seeds and how she had loved those, you know, her whole life. And then a year later, she died of colon cancer because they really didn't look at the overall causation of anything. They treated what her symptoms looked like. And I think a lot of times we don't integrate all that stuff into the whole child. We take out those little pieces and we'll go, okay, for this, we're going to treat it this way. With this, we're going to treat it that way. With that, but we don't look at the impact that all these different treatments have on the total integration of that child. And in what I do, it's more about how did all of these components work together, you know, to help that individual in order to be more successful. And there desperately needs to be a behavioral section, because I think behavioral gains are going to be some of the most marketable, you know, for our kids over time. We always talk about eliminating them. It's not about eliminating them, again. It's about changing or giving the child the appropriate skills in order to be successful, not just getting rid of what this thing looks like. Because we know that if you get rid of something and you don't replace it, the kid will replace it for you. And we need to, in that behavioral section, be looking at, just like goals and objectives for math or science or social studies or whatever it is, academically, it's the same as behaviorally. So what are we going to do? How are we going to teach this kid, the coping mechanisms that they need in order to bring their stress level down? What coping mechanisms are we going to use, or what strategies are we going to use when the child feels like they're overwhelmed and needs to go to a place where they can, you know, decompress? And I don't think we think often enough about that. We think about more of what the negative behavior is. So how are we going to get rid of the aggression? How are we going to get rid of the biting? How are we going to get rid of the sitting? As opposed to, all right, why is this occurring? And how can we help this kid to have a different, more functional equivalent to get the same need or want that's appropriate in the environment that they're in? And I don't think we write those goals and objectives the same way we write the ones that are a little bit more tangible to us, like the math or the science or those types. And then play skills. I think play skills, again, especially for the little ones, you know, as long as I've been around this field, and it's been for quite a long time, we've done a really nice job of getting our kids to deal with adults. We've done a very poor job of getting them to interact with their peers. And they will, over time, start to seek adults out because we're safer. And if we don't instill that, if you look at any of the research on social skills teaching, they all are very clear, and it's obvious that all of those social skills teaching programs need to start at the preschool level and below. I mean, those things have to start early. You've got to start having the kids understand what those skills are, and again, understanding what those functional equivalents are to get those needs or wants met at very, very young ages. Because if we do that through the repetition, then the kid's going to get used to it, and they're going to use the skills more effectively. If we wait as they get older, it becomes that much more difficult to incorporate those into anything that we're going to be doing as they get older. And again, we've talked about the reinforcement piece. The reinforcement piece, again, I think, you know, is probably the least assessed, but needs to be the most assessed. Because a lot of times when I see kids in classrooms, or I do functional behavior assessment, or whatever it is I'm there for, most of what comes out of it is the lack of motivation of why, you know, why do I need to know this information, or what's in it for me? What am I going to get out of it? How does this apply to my life? And what's so fascinating to me is a lot of the kids with Asperger's and high-functioning autism that I work with, they'll just tell you know, how is this impacting me? Why do I need this? And I think that's amazing, because I think, you know, we have to look at all the different ways that people are motivated and help, you know, the kids to achieve that same intermittency of reinforcement, but also understand that everybody's going to be different, everybody's going to be motivated different, and we need to understand that. And then the one that we talk about a lot, but I fail to see a lot in documents, is specific social skills teaching, and what those skills look like. And again, if the goal area is in social skills, what are the specific goals and objectives that we're going to have in place in order to help the individual to achieve, you know, what those deficit areas might look like? Because again, I think we don't do enough of the repetition of the teaching of the skill, and schools are so caught up and even in early intervention, we're so caught up with teaching certain academic skills, which, you know, to be honest with you, with most of our kids, those are the easy things to teach. It's the generalization and maintenance of the skill, and then also the social skills that are probably the most difficult. And the last one is biomedical, and you know, that coming out of a board-certified behavior analyst mouth is sometimes viewed as not good. But I do know for a fact that there's many kids that I've worked with who, through diagnosis, have biomedical issues. And all the behaviorism in the world that I can muster up or produce is not going to change, you know, if they have an allergy to something. You know, it's not going to change if they're having internal issues that anything behavioral I can control, because they can't control it. And a lot of times, ethically, as a behaviorist, I really have to look at, you know, if these things are being medically driven, that, you know, again, all the behavior stuff in the world that I can do is not going to make a dent, because the child, you know, can't control that on their own and need some kind of other intervention than I am able to provide. So really looking at the medical piece as part of that comprehensive team on understanding if the child, you know, has certain, you know, gluten allergies or casein allergies or has yeast allergies or has milk allergies or other kinds of biomedical issues, you know, that those treatments are, you know, at least from a behavioral standpoint, are baselined, and we implement whatever it is we're going to work on, and then really come up with good, clear data to support the fact that it is impacting it or it's not. Because I think the one thing that families get bombarded with a lot are these things that come out all the time on, you know, try this, try that, try this. They talk to other parents. They see it online. They talk to other groups. And again, it might have been effective for that other child, but it might not be effective for your child. So I always push back on sending people to the Autism Society website, which is autism-society.org. And there was a paper done from the panel of professional advisors several years ago on treatment-guided research. And it really helps parents to, you know, figure out almost in their own little research methodology, you know, what is it I'm trying to change? You know, what's the approach we're going to use? What's the data look like, and was it effective? And it's very basic in looking at it. but at least it gives everybody a clear idea as to, and then understanding again, you know, talking about treating symptoms again, okay, now how is that going to impact the child as a whole? Because I think a lot of times we don't look at that. We look at that one piece of it, So I've blabbed on now for an hour and a half, so.
Do you need to rest your voice?
Nope, I'm good.
Nope.
I'm good. Nope.
Oh, well, we've had a lot of good questions come in. I want to let everyone that's listening via phone know that if you would like to ask a question of Dr. Ball, just press star 2, and that will alert me that you've got your hand raised, and I will patch you through. In the meantime, some questions have come in through the website. I have questions. Questions galore. Since you are Dr. Ball BCBAD, you're BC bad, do you normally use an ABA type approach? Is that the structure?
Yeah, I believe, and this is my own philosophy. I believe that any kid that I've ever met on the spectrum, and I've worked with kids as young as 22 months. Up through individuals that, you know, were 65. And especially the younger ones that I've worked with in the very beginning, I think all need to start out in a very behavioral approach. And then as they progress and get older and they start to develop some of their skill level, then they're going to take us where they need to go. So then maybe a green span or maybe a teach method or maybe some of the other ones that are out there would be more effective on helping them to expand on those skill levels. But I think in the very beginning, the most important thing for the kid that I work with is really understanding that in order to survive in an educational setting, that they need to be able to respond to adult direction. And I think that comes more so from a very behavioral approach, which would then be an applied behavior analysis approach. But don't get applied behavior analysis mixed up with discrete child teaching, because not all kids on the spectrum require discrete child teaching. And I think people get them confused because once they hear one, they equate it with the other. And
DTT is more of the sit at the table one-to-one.
Yeah, and some kids require that. And it's also very robotic in nature sometimes. It's very systematic, where even some of our other kids would still be in an applied behavior analysis approach because it's about the science of it. It's about reinforcing, motivating, generalizing, and maintaining behaviors and skill levels. So an incidental teaching is a teaching methodology of ABA also. And incidental teaching is how we teach neurotypical kids. So it's not about the teaching methodology. It's more about the science of the behavioral approach.
And where does NET fit into that, natural environment?
Well, the natural environment is going to be probably the best location, especially if you're going to do the incidental teaching, for the kid to learn. You know, most of their skill level would be much more in the natural environment. But with some of our kids, they might need to start out in an environment that's a little bit more structured because they can navigate that environment better, and as they get better at their skill level, would then be able to go more into a natural environment.
Mm-hmm. You may have already answered this question, but Cheryl from Greensboro asks, as a child gets older, is ABA still the most effective strategy for him to learn? Does a child reach an age where ABA is no longer viable, when it no longer works?
Well, again, I think that's where the confusion comes in, because as the question was asked, the first thing I thought of was discrete trial teaching again. And now, discrete trial teaching is not always going to be the most important, but the applied behavior analysis approach is. And if you even look at some of your best neurotypical classroom teachers, they're using a behavioral approach. They use behavioral momentum. They use reinforcement. They use prompting techniques. Their curriculum is very standardized, even though they teach in a more eclectic way, which would be more like incidental teaching. So some kids will require discrete trial, you know, for a longer period of time. But as they get older, they can move more into a incidental teaching model and then be able to be more, in the natural environment, because that's what the natural environment uses to teach. It's more of that incidental teaching method.
Okay. And as far as evaluations for, if you're going to use a behavior approach, ABA approach, would you suggest ABLES R, VB MAP? What kind of assessments?
I think the gold standard for diagnosis and getting to understand exactly where the kid fits in the whole scheme of this thing called autism, I think is the ADOS. That's the one that's the most the gold standard for what diagnosis is. I like the ABLES when they're young to get a baseline on where their skill level is. So I like to use the ABLES initially as the initial assessment to figure out where the kid falls on the continuum of skill level. And then from there, I like the VB map to map the child out over time, because I think it's better for, as the child ages, it gives you a better roadmap.
Okay. Megan from Illinois asks, I have a 6-year-old Aspie. He is mainstreamed. He is very anxious about lunch. I have set him up with a lunch buddy, but he still complains about the length of time, all the noise, confusion, smells. She says, I want to help him, but not sure if allowing him to sit elsewhere is giving in, allowing him to get his way.
I think that, I don't know the child, but I would say that if he's navigating it now and staying in there, then I would give him opportunities maybe to escape when it gets too overwhelming for him. So maybe give him, and I always call them get-out-of-jail-free cards, but I would give him a couple cards where, hey, you've got two opportunities to leave, but you're going to come back. So this way, at least if he feels overwhelmed, it gives him a way to get out, calm himself down, and then get back in. And what I would really do is with the lunch buddy is almost use it as peer-mediated instruction and teach that child how to keep him or teach him calming techniques. So if he sees the kid start, her son start to get, more active or starts to, pre-meltdown things to talk him through it, to get him through it. So it's almost like peer-mediated instruction, and that's been very, very effective. If you look at the work of, Jed Baker, he's got some really good stuff out on social skills teaching with that.
And would you have to teach the peer how to do that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, you would, and Jed's stuff really looks at teaching the peers, because, again, in the beginning, there's really going to be no quantitative social skills development in the child unless you're including the peers in it. And in the beginning, the peers need to be trained on how to keep the kid in the here and now, need to keep the kid engaged in a conversation, need to keep the kid so that they just don't walk away from it. They become part of it. So by empowering them to have that knowledge, it's always fascinating to watch how they then teach other kids, and then our kids get involved in it, and it's just a snowball effect, and then all of a sudden everybody's, talking with our kid because they're using the strategies that we taught, and then that even helps our kid because of the repetition, because then the kids will stay in the conversation or the activity.
Okay, we have a question from Sumia in Rabat. She asks, hi, my autistic daughter is 18 years old, and I want to know if there's a specific program to enhance motivation to learn when the autistic person is adult and they don't like using toys, and at the same time they don't have adult skills.
There's a reinforcer assessment out there called a forced reinforcer assessment.
Forced?
Forced, F-O-R-C-E-D.
Okay.
And if she emails me, I will send her a copy of it.
How about if I do too?
Okay. Yep.
Can I have one too?
Yep.
Did you have a slide with your contact information?
No, I don't think I did. Wait, yeah, I did. I'll go back to the beginning.
Okay, just, yeah, if you want to put that one up. And then if folks want to contact you, they can.
Yep.
Okay. Again, anyone calling on the phone who wants to ask a question, just press star 2, and I'll see your hand raised. In the meantime, I'll go back to the questions that have come in through the website. Let's see. Sonia from Georgia asks, my baby is 11 years old and reading on a first grade level. He reads and we read to him every day, but it's hard for him to understand what he's reading, so comprehension is low. What can we do?
Well, the first thing, if you do read to him or he does read a lot, you do want to stop as often as possible and ask as many WH questions as possible to get him used to the repetition of the question asking so that he learns to read critically and pick up that information. But a lot of our kids don't do that at all. So there's a curriculum out there called EDMARK, E-D-M-A-R-K, and it's a comprehension-based reading program. And you can get it on the computer or you can get it in a hard copy, and it incorporates the comprehension in the learning of the words. Because what ends up happening with a lot of our kids is they'll rote memorize a lot of words and be able to read beautifully, but then they don't grasp what the concepts are that they're trying to get out of the material. And at least in that EDMARK reading series, it really helps them to, through the exercises that the curriculum does, is to grasp what those key components or core concepts are.
Okay. Tracy from Hong Kong asks, could you give some strategies on how to calm a child down when getting frustrated and how to teach them how to avoid getting too overwhelmed?
The coping mechanisms, there's several. I mean, there's a lot of research out on practiced relaxation techniques. And if you're really interested in those types of things, which are probably the best, that you teach the child that when they feel a certain way and you have them define it, that they go and do like deep breaths or a variety of others. There's a lot of great work that's been done by June Grodin at the Grodin Center. And if you web search her, it's G-R-O-D, I believe it's E-N, and she's out of Providence, Rhode Island. She wrote a lot on practice relaxation and also visual imagery to help kids to really, you know, before they get all hyped up to calm themselves. You might also want to look into occupational therapy or work with an occupational therapist, because a lot of times they have some very good strategies and you can teach the child to, you know, as opposed to getting to that point of no return, they go and they may bounce on a ball or they may jump on a trampoline just to get that stress out before they reach that point where they have that meltdown.
Okay. And Shubhada from New Jersey asks, it might be your neighbor, can you please talk some more about how to rescue the day? For instance, I know as soon as my son, 6 years old, wakes up, what kind of day it is going to be. If he is hyper and excited, I know he will ruin the school day just being silly. Is there some way we could rescue the situation?
Well, again, that, you know, it sounds to me that, you know, the sensory aspect there needs to be regulated, and he might need, you know, and I would seriously work with the occupational therapist on developing some kind of sensory diet to help him to bring himself down from there, you know, so that he can get some of that input that he's craving through the silliness and all that to bring himself down so that he's at an even keel, so that he can be in a better position to learn. Because a lot of times, you know, whatever it is we're doing, behaviorally or biomedically or even medically, you know, with kids, it should all be about, you know, how to get them in a better position to learn. Because bottom line is we want them to learn the skills that they need, you know, over time to be successful so that we don't need to be there all the time.
Mm-hmm. this next question is loaded for me because I homeschool my 14-year-old autistic child. And so uh-huh. Kathleen from Georgia asks, do you think homeschooling is appropriate for a child who has typical autism as long as they have clinical-based ABA?
And a component that has some kind of inclusionary opportunity. And when I say inclusionary opportunity, it doesn't necessarily mean that they have to be in a school program, but they're in, around, or with some neurotypical peer at some point, because I think, you know, for them to be successful as they grow older, in order to be successful and to enhance their quality of life, they're going to need to be in those kinds of arrangements where it may be, you know, that they go to the store, maybe they go to the Barnes & Noble and do your reading, or somewhere where they're engaged with people at least to some level that they can be, you know, depending on how they, you know, how they present, you know, with their autism spectrum disorder. But I think that, you know, the program, as, you know, using an applied behavior analysis approach, you know, depending on the teaching methodology that you use, which would be specific to the child, I think the only thing that would be missing in that scenario would be some kind of inclusionary opportunity.
Okay. Rebecca from Iowa asks, how can we use many of the time-intensive strategies you mentioned, such as shaping, generalization, video modeling, in the general education classroom and keep the kids with autism at pace with their peers in the curriculum?
Well, I think if they're, again, what are your goals for that child in the inclusionary opportunity? I think a lot of times we do inclusion just for the sake of inclusion, because I'll go into classrooms and see kids in situations that I just look at everybody and I'm like, you know, what are you guys doing here, and what's the goal for this child to be here? And they can't really give me one, because, again, in the IEP, there should be specific goals and objectives that we're trying to achieve. Is it that we're trying to, you know, if it's for socialization, then, you know, I wouldn't put the kid in algebra because there's not a lot of socialization that goes on in algebra. But if it's that the kid is on grade level in algebra or with some modification is going to do well in algebra, then that child should be in there. So in this particular case, if that child is deemed to be appropriate in that particular setting, shaping can be very easily done in those settings because you would just give that child either fewer things to do than the rest of the environment does, and then build up to what the rest of the kids do, or even in chaining, giving him real or her real specific steps as to what her skill gains are going to be, even though the other kids may get the gains a little bit more. We just bring that child along at a slower pace, and you can do it in chunk, what they call it, chunking the work. Just chunk the work so that they're not doing as many as everybody else is. And that will help to use those strategies. I think the reinforcement one just speaks for itself, and so does the behavioral momentum one. The play, obviously, if in the younger grades, you know, they need opportunities to play. So if they're in a kindergarten class or even in a first grade class, they're going to have a little bit more of that opportunity. And then as they get older, it comes down to doing some structured things around recess. And I think the repetition, you know, also speaks for itself because I think you need to do the things with that individual child over and over again.
Okay. A couple of people have asked for you to repeat the information about the resource for biomedical. Was that the Autism Society website?
Yeah, autism-society.org. And there's a white paper from the panel of professional advisors on treatment-guided research. They can also go to autismnj, as in New Jersey, .org, and they have a similar paper from their panel of professional advisors looking again at families' ability to, evaluate when they're using alternative methods that haven't been fully researched yet.
Okay. Tracy from Hong Kong asks, can you share some insights in how to teach theory of mind social skills?
It's one of the most difficult things to do because a lot of times our kids are so egocentric and don't really look at that, the best place to get that information would be through Michelle Garcia Winner, Social Thinking. I mean, I know she's got some webinars, too. I think you can go to her website. She is a great resource on that.
Great. See, I think we have time for maybe one or two more questions here.
Yep.
Let's see. Well, I don't know. I'll throw this one out. You can do your best. Tammy from Punxsutawney asks, my daughter is 13 and on kindergarten level academically. Do you suggest any programs that would help? She's in an autistic classroom, but I feel we are getting nowhere.
It's always interesting because I think with a lot of our kids, I would be looking at what the expectation level is for her. If you go to my website, which is www.jbautismconsulting.com, or you can see from my information on my on the screen, you can just web search it, you'll find it. But it's www.jbautismconsulting.com. And if you go to my publications, I did an article, God, it's got to be 3 or 4 years now, for the Autism Asperger's Digest magazine, and it was on rethinking how we teach the child with more challenging autism. And I think that article, it's only a two-pager, but it's very well read, but it's got a lot of good information on it. I think that would help you tremendously on looking at different ways of approaching how you teach your daughter as opposed to just the basic expectations of whatever she gives us, and then, you know, we have that expectation like, oh, okay, that's all we're going to get, as opposed to raising the bar higher.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I can't pronounce this name, but I'm going to try. I hope I don't butcher it. Aradhana from India asks, if a child in the autism spectrum is on therapy under the supervision of a trained BCBA, is it required to see a speech therapist? If yes, why? Doesn't the assessment using ABLES and VBMAP include language goals?
Yeah, it's not imperative. I mean, it wouldn't be imperative that she sees a speech and language pathologist. I mean, I think a lot of times they'll augment what they do through the use, of a speech and language therapist. But yes, the ABLES would be assessing language. And since with most of our kids it's a communication handicap, most of the people who work with the kids are going to be doing tons of speech and language programming. So they're going to be proficient at it. They don't have the skill level or the academic criteria, that a speech and language pathologist has, but they're going to be doing the same types of therapies because most of the programming is going to be geared around speech and language. So it's not imperative, and a lot of people just use it as something to augment it.
Okay. And Lucy from Maine asks, my 14-year-old granddaughter has Asperger's. She still likes playing with dolls and things that are not typically age-appropriate. I feel as long as she is playing at home with them, it's okay, but her mother has taken all of these things away from her, insisting that she play with things that are age-appropriate. What is your opinion?
I am the firm believer on you use whatever works. And if her motivator is dolls and she likes dolls, and I like the way Grandma said, as long as she does it in the house or she does it in her room, and nowhere else that would like stigmatize her with her peer group, then I would have no problem with her doing it. I would just teach her the appropriate time and place so that she's not stigmatized in some kind of social opportunity.
Okay. Brian from Hong Kong asks, what kind of adaptations would you suggest we discuss with the mainstream classroom teacher who doesn't have experience with high-functioning autism or ADHD?
My first thing would be to discuss with them the prompting hierarchy, because what happens a lot of times is because the child is verbal, people tend to talk to the child, when in a lot of cases they might not be processing the language or understanding everything, but they know they have to give a response. And a lot of times they might get it right, and then people move on and they think the kid understands something or has a skill that they really don't have. And if you understand the prompting hierarchy of using a variety of different nonverbal prompts to get the kid to be successful, then you're going to be that much better with that child. And that's the use of, you know, physical prompts, gestural prompts, positional prompts, locational prompts, visual prompts. You know, there's a whole host of different prompts, you know, that can be utilized. And a lot of times what we end up doing with that child is we end up using verbal prompts. And sometimes verbal prompts, well, in most cases, verbal prompts are the hardest prompts to fade, because if you're not there, the child won't be successful. And we wonder why, when they have to do seat work or other, or have to do other activities that the teacher's not totally involved in, that they have some behavioral issues. And it's normally around the fact that they don't understand what the expectation is, again, and we're using a variety of different prompting levels with them, or prompting hierarchies that are just not appropriate at that time. So I would really, with any brand new staff I work with that's got a child on the spectrum, it's all about using those prompts and especially visuals initially in order to make the kid successful, and then we would build from there.
Okay, I think I have time for one more, and this question I'm going to kind of lump from several that have come in, generalizing it here, but folks are having trouble getting the school system to buy into an intervention or something that they would like to do for their child, such as circle of friends, a peer buddy. How would you suggest they go about pushing the issue?
The best and most appropriate way of doing it is to reconvene an IEP meeting, which every family can do as often as they would like, and putting in specific goals and objectives in that document that would support what it is they're looking for. So if they're looking for a circle of friends because the child is having issues with, you know, their social skills, then there should be a social skills section of that IEP. And in that section, if the goals and objectives that the staff are using now are not getting the results that the family is looking for, then you would look to revise those goals and or those objectives that are under that goal. And that might be your circle of friends. If you're looking at peer-mediated instruction, then that would then come into play there also. So you would put it into the legal document, and that would be your push. Because once it's in the document, then it's got to be done as part of the program. So you talk to your blue in the face and talk to them to your blue in the face. If it's not in the document, they're not mandated by law to do it.
And then if it's in the document and they don't do it, they have legal recourse.
Then you have legal recourse, and then you can get, then you can then look for compensatory services for the time that these were not being done.
Mm-hmm. Great. I mean, I think we've hit on so many topics this evening. I want to thank you for being here, Dr. Ball. It's been a pleasure.
Well, Nancy, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
I've learned so much. My paper is full, and I have another long to-do list, as usual. I want to mention our next webinar for everyone who's listening. It will be December 7th, and we will welcome Paul Nittich. He is a financial planner, and he will be discussing financial planning for special needs. If you would like a transcript of this event tonight, please join our Spectrum Gold Club by clicking the button on the screen. We will send you a copy of the webinar audio and transcript, plus send you 29 other webinars when you join. Also, tell us what you think. Call us at 877-211-0212, extension 1, and leave a short comment or a testimonial. That number again is 877-211-0212. I want to thank everyone for attending, especially you, Dr. Ball. And I bid you a fond farewell and a good night.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Good night.